The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Well, we've got a great agenda lined up here for us today. Jackie has bought an electric vehicle, and so we are going to do the consumer report from Jackie's perspective.
That's right, and my new EV challenge.
Your EV challenge.
You're going to hear more about it.
Minus 33, I think it was a week or two ago. I can't remember. Anyway, we've got the clean fuel standard. I want to give people an update. That's in the Gazette, as they call it, in the federal government right now. And so it's an ongoing work in progress that will affect us here in Western Canada, not only in our oil and gas industry, but I think it's got ramifications, as we've discussed in the past, to our agricultural industry.
So let's talk about my new Model Y. So
you've transitioned.
Yeah, our family has transitioned at the end of December. We're a little bit tougher, harder core than you, Peter, because this is like our only family car.
Mm.
As unpractical as it is, our other car doesn't have enough seats for everyone in the family. So this
and
is the one.
And the dog, too.
And the dog. So this is the one that we're going to try to take all our trips on. We'll see if we're going to last. The other option is that we change the other vehicle to be a bit bigger, but I'd like to see if we can try to make this work.
The Tesla Model Y.
Yeah, as our main vehicle. And if people don't know about the Model Y, it's fairly new. It came out just in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Tesla's doing quite well with it. They don't actually put out their official sales numbers. They lump them together. But analysts predict that 7 out of 10 of the cars that Tesla is selling right now are the Model Y.
It's and like an SUV crossover-sized vehicle, right?
Yeah, it's really the first thing on the market that would work for a family. It actually has the same capacity inside as our Jeep Cherokee, which is kind of hard to believe just looking at it, but it really does have a lot of storage capacity. It has a 500-kilometer range.
Or that's the sticker. We're going to talk about
that. That's the sticker range. Yeah. Well, that seems pretty good. Like, how many trips do you go on that are more than 500? That's 5 hours driving. Who wants to drive more than that? Obviously, everything about the Tesla and the electric cars, like, they're fun to drive.
You get the performance.
No, no. I went against your advice there. I didn't know I'd need to go any faster. It seems to go pretty fast for me as it is.
Yeah.
And it has the four-wheel drive. It's not quite like the Jeep Cherokee, but it's still really good in the snow. I don't think you can get
too stuck in it. So you traded the Jeep Cherokee in for a Tesla.
Yeah, that's the switch here.
Okay.
So there's lots of things I really love about the car that I didn't even know about. You know, you never told me about Netflix in the car, Ron.
Mm.
We've been using that quite a bit. Now that all you can do is get takeout food, you sit in the car. You know, we can like watch Netflix, connected to Spotify, karaoke.
Yeah.
Have you spent a lot of time with the karaoke, Peter?
I'm not
Peter?
Good at singing, no. I do not use that feature.
Yeah, it's like karaoke, but they call it karaoke. And it's a lot of fun. I wouldn't say that my husband's enjoying it as much as my daughter and I, but I think there's just some really fun features. They have whoopee cushion seats and other kind of like prank things in there.
They've made it. It's no surprise it's a cult car, an enjoyable vehicle to drive. But I mean, I must say, I love the console and the electronic features. The mapping is outstanding and so on. So there's a lot of good features. But we're going to talk about the pros and the cons based on your experiences. I've been driving one for almost 5 years and it's just become commonplace for me. So I don't even think about the pros and cons anymore. But let's talk about the economics.
Okay, let's talk about the economics. I'm going to come back to more pros as we get into the winter driving because there are some pros. But of course, as you know, Peter, I made numerous spreadsheets analyzing this decision, as every person that looks at these cars might. I think this is actually a pretty good economic decision because filling up the tank at home cost me about $5 compared to about $63 for a comparable ICE today. And so if I drive 20,000 kilometers a year, I'm going to save over $2,000 on fuel and probably $1,000 on maintenance because I don't need to get oil changes or anything. It's debatable if this car is actually more money than a comparable car, actually, because I would argue I don't know that there's truly a comparable car. Maybe the BMW Model 3, but people have told me the performance isn't as good. So, maybe it's not comparable. But if it were comparable, I'm probably going to take about 3 years to make the difference up in the capital cost by my fuel and maintenance savings. And you could argue maybe that's too much. But here, this is the thing. That's with today's fuel prices. So if we fast forward to 2030, when I still think I'm going to have this car, actually. We'll see, because I keep cars for a long time. Then the carbon price is $170 in Canada. Then I'm saving like $3,500 a year in fuel costs. And add that with my maintenance, which for an older car is probably going to be even bigger saving. Like, I'm probably saving like $5,000 a year by then by having this vehicle. So this thing's like printing me
money.
Well,
and there's the maintenance. There's hardly any maintenance. You've got that calculation in there.
Yeah, I added another $1,500 to get to the $5,000. So, you know, at that point, when you burden the gasoline with that kind of tax, then I would say that there's already like a huge benefit for the electric.
There's a huge benefit if you look at it just by the numbers. And over time, if the price of gasoline goes up because of carbon taxes and the capital cost of electric vehicles goes down, the economics get more and more compelling.
Yeah.
However, academic studies that look at these sorts of things is that people generally don't take the full amount of the savings into their consideration. In other words, they discount it heavily. They would say, oh, okay, it's going to save me $1,000 a year by the spreadsheet. In their heads, it's only $100 a year. It's discounted heavily. And therefore, they'll just say, well, why would I change? I am just going to stick with what I know and I don't have any range anxiety. That's how the psychology works. Most people don't sit with a spreadsheet and figure it out.
Right. Well, and the capital cost up front being higher is a barrier, right? Like people may
not
have
that
capital cost right now. Mm. I think they're getting pretty close in this range. For sure, when you go to the lower end, like the Leafs and Bolts, they're pretty expensive relative to the comparable car. But when you get into like this level, they're pretty comparable, a little bit more, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, in the, I don't know what the segment's called, the mid-size luxury market where you have Audi, Mercedes, BMW, Tesla, that mid-size range, which the Model Y is in, and it's doing exceedingly well.
Yeah, and I think
because the performance is so much superior, in my opinion.
The performance is good. The price may be slightly higher, but at the same time, there's quite a bit of savings for having them too. But let's talk about the utility of the vehicle. And you mentioned range anxiety. So the 500 kilometers, we did a lot of discussion, as you can imagine, you know, all these different trips that we may do or may want to do, and would we be able to do them? But then I came back to, we're talking about a trip that we did once in 5 years, and that's a barrier for us to buy this car. You know, these trips that you do outside of your little normal path are like 1% of your driving, right? Once I got my mind around that, it was like, okay, well, we mainly just go out to the mountains or go like to Edmonton or, you know, a couple hundred kilometers from our home. That's like 99% of our travel.
But that's an important point, that line of thinking, because a lot of people who have the range anxiety think that way. Oh, I won't be able to go to, I don't know, Williams Lake or somewhere. It's important that you mention that because I think a lot of people factor the possibility that they may take a long trip to somewhere where there may not be charging infrastructure into their buying decision. And that one trip becomes a huge barrier for them to switch from a gasoline vehicle to an electric vehicle. In other words, there's huge option value that the buyer places on relatively rare events.
I came around to thinking, okay, once in the last 5 years we did this particular trip, this thing's saving me so much money in fuel, then I would just rent a car for that three-day weekend that I needed to do that trip, but I'd still be ahead, right?
You would be, but it's an option value thing in a sense that I can have the hassle of renting a car, going, picking it up and dropping it off, and I'd rather just stick with what I know.
Yeah, for sure.
These are psychological factors in this overall thing called range anxiety. And even though, like you said, maybe it's not 500 kilometers as a range, maybe it's 400, it's still a lot. And yes, you can find plenty of places now to charge. It's just those exceptions that, oh, I may be stuck somewhere in the middle of nowhere, or it may be really cold, which we're going to talk about. And therefore, I'll just stick with what I know.
Let's talk about that. So first thing we did is do a trip out to Lake Louise to prove that we could do it. And it was only about -1 or -2°C, and it worked really well. Like Tesla predicts how much battery you're going to have when you get there, how much you're going to need to get home. In this case, we needed to stop at Canmore on the way back. We stopped at that supercharger, and like within 10 minutes, we added like 200 kilometers and off we went. So
that was
-1,
right?
That was -1. So I was like, this is like no problem. And this is way better than I thought. So then came the cold snap that we had a few weeks ago, and we took it out to Canmore at -25, and I had all the metrics, you know, how much energy I used the first trip to Canmore when it was -2, and we lost over 20% of our range because of the cold weather. I was kind of expecting that because if you do any reading, that's to be expected. But my takeaway is, how often do we get that cold of weather, really? And do we really go skiing when it's that cold?
No.
But I wouldn't think that I would really want to take this car on big trips on the cold weather. And I certainly wouldn't want to take it to my hometown Grand Prairie where they get the extreme cold weather. The other issue, by the way, there's no charging infrastructure, like fast charging infrastructure that way. So that's another topic we'll talk about.
Yeah, if you're going places on the highway or, as say, remote places, it's a problem. I think that that is a consideration when we think about the transition from petroleum-powered vehicles to electric vehicles in a country that's as big as ours, that has remote communities and has very cold temperatures.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an issue. There's no question about it.
By the way, I do want to say that combustion engines, they do good in cold weather, but there are problems. You know, I've seen a lot of AMA trucks booting around the city during that cold spell.
The positives of having an electric car in winter is there's no starting issues. You just flip the switch and away you go.
Well, there's some real positives. Like, for instance, when you walk up to the car, it already senses your cell phone and you're there, and it's already started the heat. It's instantly hot. You just jump into a warm car.
Yeah, I mean, if we're out for at a restaurant, you just launch the app from your phone and turn on the heater. And by the time you pay the bill and go out, it's hot.
And here's another really great feature that I never would have thought of is, you know, we have this dog and they have a feature where you can leave your dog in the car and you put it into dog mode and it just keeps the inside of the car 20 degrees for the dog. And we've used that a lot. I have to admit, I've left my kid in there too. And you don't have to be running the engine, right? Or if we're eating takeout food, which we do often in the car these days, you can just be like watching Netflix nice and warm in your car and sit there for like a half hour and you're not running the exhaust. So there are a lot of advantages in the winter too.
No, there are a lot of advantages, but it's an issue. I've had a few people email me or communicate with me otherwise, you know, ha ha ha, how's your electric vehicle going in the minus 30? And I say just fine. But I sort of take those comments in the broader sense because I sense that there still is range anxiety. There still is reluctance to make the switch for whatever reason. And I think those sorts of psychological barriers, we still got a long way to go if we're going to get wholesale transition to electric vehicles.
Yeah. Okay. As a new driver here, I think the biggest problem is we need way more charging spots. You know, we've got, for example, a charger for Tesla in Canmore. Mm-hmm. And then they have a map of all the ones that are coming. They have one at Golden, but there's not one towards Fernie. It's coming soon, according to the map. There's not one at Jasper. There's not one towards Invermere. All of these have little things on the map coming soon. I don't know when that is.
Yeah.
And then Petro-Canada's putting in their fast charging. And they actually have, if you go look at the map, along the Highway 1 across Canada, you've got fast charging network already there. So like Golden, Salmon Arm, Canmore, Medicine Hat, Kelowna, like you can basically cross this country with Petro-Canada. But the problem is they don't work for my Tesla. I need to get this adapter that costs $600. But even then, it's no longer a supercharger because with that adapter, it makes it go from fast to something like in my garage.
Why Petro-Canada, which has so many stations, is not adapting to the Tesla plug.
Well, okay, apparently...
which is the number one selling electric vehicle. Like, what sense does that make?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, they're thinking long-term, but Tesla only lets their stuff be used for Tesla stations.
Sure.
So this is Tesla's problem,
okay,
too.
Okay, maybe it's Tesla's issue.
But apparently there's a new adapter in Europe coming out. It's already available in Europe that costs way less. Like, it's like $100, and I can actually charge fast with that particular adapter. But I want, for any of those policymakers tuning in here in Canada, we've got to mandate one plug in this country. Like, I think this is just ridiculous. In Europe, the government forced one plug type. So Tesla can no longer decide they want to have their special plug and Toyota and others have a different plug. We have a huge country with very few people. We can't afford to be making redundant infrastructure. For instance, at Golden, you got a Tesla charging station and a Petro-Canada. And I'm sure there's other companies too. But we would be much smarter to put one in Golden and one halfway to Kamloops instead of having, you know, redundant infrastructure in the same location that only half of the cars or a third of the cars can use.
We're in the early days of these plugs. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's asinine, but I mean, there's historical precedent for this. When the light bulb came out, you know, 100 and some years ago, there was Thomas Edison's screw bulb, which, by the way, that screw thread in your standard light bulb is the same screw thread and size as the wick assembly for a kerosene lantern.
Oh, really?
So, in the early days of the light bulb, when many manufacturers were popping up, I think there was over 200 different types of screw bases. And so it had to standardize and a dominant design had to fall out of it in North America. In Europe, they have different light bulb assembly. The wall plugs. Could you imagine if different builders had different wall sockets. And you had to go to the store to buy a lamp or a toaster or whatever. And you had all different types of things. It's not that way, thankfully. There's one kind of plug in the wall and one kind of plug in the appliances that we buy. And this is where we have to go with electric vehicles. You can't have all these different kind of things. And, you know, you pull up to a charging station in some rural spot. There's a bag of adapters they give you. Fumble, okay, which one is the adapter? Oh, sorry, I don't have that one. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. And then on top of that, the adapter doesn't give you the current that you need to charge.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest
quickly.
Problem. Yeah. You need fast charging. You're not sitting there for 3 hours. You need to be sitting there for a half hour.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can learn from history, because to me, if the goal is to move to EVs as fast as possible and to ban the combustion engine by 2035, and the government, by the way, if I go look at the Liberal climate plan that came out in December, they're putting $150 million into charging stations. And to date, they've already put in 4,300 charging stations. Do they have a say in making sure that's an efficient use of taxpayers' money? We should learn from the past and nip this in the bud as fast as possible, the way the Europeans
have. There should
be
a standard. And historically, it's the company that's got the dominant market share that prevails. You know, the Edison lights. That's why we event all the other 199 companies, different bases, didn't make it, and Edison's did. It's the same whether it was beta versus VHS as that kind of standard, or generally speaking, why Microsoft Excel format, the .xl, XLS, or whatever it is, format is a standard format that even the other spreadsheet competitors sort of adapt to ultimately. There is one typically dominant one. To me, the Tesla is the dominant one, but all the charging stations that are coming out are not necessarily Tesla.
But I would just say that in Europe, they actually forced them to go to a more generic one, and Tesla's had to do that. Sure. So I just think in the past, okay, we could have the competitors slug it out like the past, but in this case, if there's urgency around reducing our use of fossil fuels, I think the government should step in. Why should we lose 5 years and spend hundreds of millions of dollars on infrastructure that's inefficient?
Somebody pulls up to a station and finds out they don't have the right adapter.
Yeah, well, and it's also, like you say, it keeps people from adopting these technologies.
Sure.
It pushes off the acceleration of some of these alternatives. So I think that's a no-brainer, and I'd like to see some policy around
that. So we're waiting for a dominant design on the plug-ins, and I heard there's just dozens and dozens of new electric vehicle manufacturers popping up in China, and
GM's getting into it.
There are standards listed for some of these plugs, but every manufacturer is adopting a different one. Every charging company station one has to have these adapters and things.
Yeah, but now's the time to do it, right? As these companies are really ramping up their production, as a wait 5 years when GM has, what are they saying, 30 different models, well, why wouldn't we try to do it now so there's consistency today? Okay, let's move on to the clean fuel standard. We did have a podcast in December. We called it the 101 podcast.
Yep.
And we didn't get into the details of the Canadian policy because it wasn't really out yet, but it was released in December. And I can put a link to that draft policy on the show notes of this. But as a reminder, the goal is to reduce the carbon intensity of liquid fuels in Canada by a bit over 10% between now and 2030. And you can do it by reducing your carbon intensity of the fossil fuel. So like reducing the emissions associated with producing the oil and gas. You could do it by blending in lower carbon fuels like biofuels, or you could use EVs and other sources of transportation that are lower carbon. I just wanted to very quickly go over some highlights and remind people that you can comment up to March 4th, 2021, and the Draft Gazette actually has the details of how you comment.
So anybody can go online and comment?
Yeah, anyone can. And I mean, this is a major policy. If you're in energy in Canada, I mean, this is a really consequential policy. So I definitely encourage people to voice their opinions. I think it really can make an impact.
So what would you recommend people? They go to the website, there's a box that says, enter your comments here. I don't think they're going to respond to people saying this is a lousy idea, which is sort of a tendency for some to do, or this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I think the comment boxes are there to say how to improve upon it, or I'm concerned about this, I'm concerned about that.
Yeah, I think so. The government has clearly said they want to move forward, so it would be within the nuances of the policy. Now, one big thing that wasn't expected when we had our podcast is that they announced that this is only going to be for liquid fuels now. It's not going to be for gaseous and
like natural
and coal,
gas. It's not going to include natural gas.
Yeah. So that was welcome news for many major natural gas consumers in Canada who had voiced concerns about this maybe increasing the price of gas by a dollar a gigajoule over the next 10 years. There's a downside to it too, though. It would have been a big driver for the hydrogen economy because it would have created a lot of incentive to get going with hydrogen, and we've lost that now. That said, they introduced the $170 carbon tax, which will create some incentive for hydrogen as well. But I think we've lost some of the driver for the hydrogen economy. That said, I think most people are pretty happy about the change because of the concerns that, you know, a lot of our industrial consumers are creating goods and products that need to compete on the global stage, and right. they didn't want to have an uncompetitive energy price.
This is a very complicated piece of legislation. I mean, it's just got a lot of intricacies and nuances and covers a large waterfront of energy supply chain. And so what is it that's new here?
Well, that change is really big, right?
The gas use
a lot
one.
Of people were thinking, oh, suddenly I might invest in hydrogen, and now they're more concerned. By the way, there is a little bit of a loophole that says, you know, if you're creating emissions because of natural gas or coke use, if you reduce that, you could actually sell those credits, but a limited amount. A supplier of fuel like Suncor or Parkland could buy up to 10% of their credits from you. So there is some ability to make some changes in our natural gas and our use of coal. But it's a pretty small market. So I've heard people say I'd like a little bit larger market for that.
I want to talk about that word market, because the clean fuel standard right now is largely theory. And on paper, we can debate the merits of sections of it or whatever. But let's just say, okay, it makes sense and there's opportunity here. But the market, like these credits, there's no trading mechanism yet that I can see.
Oh, that's part of it too. And that's all described in the document. There's going to be an electronic platform
for
trading. Yeah, that'll be all done before this is made live in 2023. So all the details are there, and you annually will do this calculation.
You know, it's just theory versus actually getting it going. How do you measure?
Yes. Yeah.
How do you issue a credit? How do you store and bank that credit? How do you actually trade it? Are there enough credits? Is there oversupply or under demand? Like, how does this?
Well, the Gazette actually does model what they think the credit situation will look like and how many will come from banked credits. By the way, if there aren't enough credits, there's an option to pay $350 a ton into a compliance fund, similar to what happens in Alberta, where you could pay into Emissions Reductions Alberta, and then that money would be used.
So is this thing going to be launched all at once? Sort of, ta-da, here's the whole thing for the broad-based, I'll call it energy economy.
The policy is live over 2022. We'd see some of that. I haven't really seen any details. But I would say that there is some stuff in the Gazette around sort of the whole logistics of it, how often you'd have to report, what the reporting would look like, what the trading platform will have. I think one big hole right now, you talked about measuring, is that this model, there's going to be a model that assigns a carbon intensity to different things. And that model isn't available right now and won't be available until close to when the Gazette 2 comes out. Until that model is done, some of this idea of how many credits will be available is uncertain because we're not sure exactly what carbon intensity would be applied to different activities.
What you mean by model is, say, an oil and gas producer, there's a gas well near Medicine Hat, and that gas well will have assigned to it a certain carbon intensity. I guess gas is a bad example. I should be using oil because we're on liquids, but you know what I mean. Okay, let's just say there's an oil well near Lloydminster, and there's going to be an assignment of a certain carbon intensity to that well in Lloydminster if that actual well has not been measured, certified, and reported. Is that what's going to happen?
Well, I think it's going to be a little higher level than every well in Western Canada, but there'll be a model, for example, that says for your biofuels facility, what are your attributes? You'll plug those in and out will come your carbon intensity number that you have. So if you're lower than the average, you're going to be able to get a premium because you're helping people meet their carbon intensity reduction. And of course, we haven't seen this model yet, but I'm imagining for oil and gas, it'll be quite generic that if you take out, you know, this much methane, then there's going to be some kind of carbon intensity associated with that. And it'll spit out how many credits you get. That's how they're going to quantify the amount of credits that come from different activities. And then once you, as a voluntary credit generator, get that, then you can go sell them on that electronic trading mechanism.
Yeah.
So there's lots of pieces to it for sure. I mean, the first time we saw a lot of these details, at least the broad public, and I know there's been information to the working groups, but to the broad public is in this document. I mean, I think another interesting thing is it was announced that the maximum price for credits would be $300 a ton in 2022, and it would be adjusted for inflation after that.
So, as we know, all these things are very complicated and confusing, but there are precedents in California, for example.
Yes.
Of low carbon fuel standard, clean fuel standard, whatever you want to call
it. NBC as well.
So they have demonstrated that it can work. Can you comment on the one that the federal government is introducing, its relative complexity, how it's going to work, and what they can learn from these jurisdictions that have already done it?
Well, I think one thing is that they probably need some changes over time. Like if you look at the California low carbon fuel standard, they allowed more ways to get credits over time because I think they found that the pathways that they had deemed part of the policy weren't enough to generate enough credits. So, you know, I think that's the one thing is that you're probably going to have to see, you know, the government did some modeling to show there'd be plenty of credits and there'd be a period, you know, around 2027, 28, where it would really tighten up and you might need to do, you know, more things like reductions from oil and gas at that time. But, you know, the reality is sometimes the market doesn't evolve like the models. And I think you're going to need to be nimble and make sure that there's enough credits out there.
I think we're going to have to be nimble. And I do wish there was a way to ease into this thing from the 100,000 foot level. On paper, I actually really quite like how it's designed. And we've seen in California, as you said, and BC to a lesser extent, it works. But it just strikes me that whenever somebody says model, I sort of step back. Modeling was my career. So I know all the assumptions that need to be made. And we've certainly had models of vaccines, of COVID-19 models, of all sorts of things. And you know that the models never really actually reflect what actually happens. It sort of just gives you a guide. I'm not saying you shouldn't model, but there's going to be bumps along the way, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so it would be nice to be able to ease into this thing rather than, as I said, race and introduce the grand plan all at once.
The one thing I'd say that might rest your mind a little, Peter, is that the first 3 or 4 years of this, we'd probably not have to do anything different because we already have biofuels mandates in Canada. And today, about 5% of all of our gasoline is ethanol and about 2% of our diesel is from biofuels. And the policy sort of goes up linearly. We want to do a 10% or a little bit more than 10% over the next 10 years. And for the first 3 or 4 years, we don't have to make any changes because the biofuels we use today are enough to make these goals. And the government modeling sort of shows that.
Okay.
So there is some time here before real changes are needed to reduce emissions over what we're doing today. And that's 3 to 4 years out. So there is some time to prepare that way.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, I think the credits will sell lower. That's what happened in California because there was plenty of credits available with what we're doing today with biofuels. But as you get out further and the intensity targets get more stringent and more big, then you start to need to do other things like generate credits from EVs or from reducing oil and gas emissions. And that's when the credit price tends to go up closer to the maximum level.
Okay.
So anyway, there's lots there. We really can't cover it all in a podcast and maybe it wouldn't be all that interesting, all the details. But I do encourage if you're in the space of energy, an oil and gas producer or obviously a fuel distributor to understand this policy. And if you have some comments to get them
I think that's the big thing is there is an opportunity to get real-time feedback from the stakeholders that are most affected by this. And based on all the comments and said my cautious skepticism about the execution of this thing, I think that it really behooves, as I said, the stakeholders to understand it and provide the feedback because there is an opportunity to raise these issues, which is really valuable for those that are rolling this program out.
Yeah, I think everyone wants it to be a success, right?
Okay. And so then they're getting feedback. Can you remind our audience again when that closes, the feedback?
March 4th.
March 4th.
In the show notes, I'll put a link to the Gazette and I'll actually reference the page that has the information about how you send that feedback in.
And then what do we expect after that? They're going to digest all this stuff. And then...
Well, a Gazette 2 will come out in December of this year, so a ways away. And that will be the final policy. Well, with that, we're going to get you to get out and let your voice be known in our democracy. And also, we'll keep you up to date on my electric car challenge. So thanks for joining our podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.